Good morning, everyone. This is Robin Mashup, Director of Education at the Prime Center, and I will be hosting our monthly pain call entitled Spotlight on Pain Management. Today's session is Effect of Mental Health Disorders on Pain and Pain Treatments in VHA Community Living Centers. I would like to introduce our presenter for today, Dr. Penny Brennan. Dr. Brennan is an investigator at the Center for Innovation to Implementation, VA Palo Alto Healthcare System. Her research interests focus on health and aging and improved health care for late, middle-aged, and older veterans. This includes research examining the effects of mental health disorders on pain and pain treatment among nursing home residents and the implementation and effects of consistent staffing in long-term care settings. We will be holding questions for the end of the talk. At the end of the hour, there will be a feedback form to fill out immediately following today's session. Please stick around for a minute or two to complete this short form, as it is critically important to help us provide you with great programming. Dr. Bob Kearns, Director of the Prime Center, will be on our call today to take any questions related to policy. And now I'm going to turn this over to our presenter.
Hello, everyone. This is Penny Brennan. Thank you so much for coming to the talk today. I want to start first by thanking several people. First, I want to thank VA HSR&D for the funding supporting me and the work that I'm about to describe. I also want to thank Sunny Lemke, Kathleen Schutte, and Sonia Suhu. They are my collaborators on this project. I want to thank Sonia Suhu especially. She ran most of the analyses yielding the results that I'll be describing, and she also made most of the slides for this presentation. So thank you very much, Sonia. I'd also like to thank Krista Hilo, Janet Barber, and Lisa Miner from the VA Office of Geriatrics and Extended Care. They've been very supportive of this project and especially helpful in helping me obtain the MDS 3.0 data to conduct the work I'm about to describe. I'd also like to thank the staff at the VA Austin Automation Center in Austin, Texas. They also were invaluable for assisting me in getting the data. Bernice Moss also deserves thanks for the analyses on the 2004 National Nursing Home Survey data I'll be describing. I want to start by talking a little bit about community nursing homes and the VA community living centers as very rich context for the study of pain and pain treatment. First, I want to distinguish between when I'm saying community nursing homes, I'm talking about non-VA nursing homes out in the community. And the VA community living centers were formerly called nursing home units. They're now called community living centers, and there are 132 of those in the VHA healthcare system. The community nursing homes and VACLCs are a heavily used health service. At age 50, if you live so long, you have about a 59% lifetime chance of using a nursing home service at some time. Right now, there are about 104 million U.S. adults receiving care in community nursing homes, and the average daily census in the VACLCs is at least 11,000 veterans. The residents in the community nursing homes and VACLCs are a mix in terms of their stay and the kinds of health care needs and health care services they're getting. About 30% of the residents are there for 90 days or fewer. About 30% are staying a year or longer, and 40% are in between. And they're getting a mixture of types of care, including shorter stay, rehab, and restorative care to get them back into the community. And then there's longer stay for chronic health problems, mental health problems, and dementia. The VACLCs and community nursing homes are somewhat unique in that they are often at a kind of a physical distance and independent of nearby healthcare systems. And so pain treatment and pain issues often take place separate from the rest of the healthcare system. So in any case, this is a very rich context for studying pain and pain treatment because you have a great variety of types of pain and pain care needs in the skilled nursing facilities and in the community and in the DA. I also wanted to talk for just a minute about the minimum data set, because that's the basis of most of the source of most of the information I'll be sharing with you. The MDS is a federally mandated resident assessment instrument that's given to residents at admission annually, quarterly, and at discharge to assess their medical conditions, but also their physical, cognitive functioning, depression, behavior problems. The MDS 2.0 was implemented in the early 90s in community living, community nursing homes, and in 2002 in the VA CLCs. And it's used for individual resident care planning as the basis of quality indicator reports and also for research. So over the years, there's been very mixed evidence about the clinical relevance of the MDS 2.0, and especially about the reliability and validity of its various subscales, including its pain items. So between 2003 and 2008, Deborah Saliba and her colleagues led a big effort to revise and revamp the MDS completely, resulting in the MDS 3.0. That was implemented in the nationwide in community nursing homes in October of 2010 and in VACLCs in July of 2012. The MDS 3.0 has greatly improved pain items over the MDS 2.0, and it provides very interesting individual-level longitudinal information about a resident's pain treatment, and health and functioning outcomes. So the prevalence of pain is high in nursing homes. It's higher than in the community. Between 49 and 84% of people who reside in nursing homes are thought to have persisting pain. And in this context, pain has been shown to be associated with depression and lowered sociability, impaired ambulation, impaired sleep, and decreased quality of life. But pain is often unrecognized and untreated in community nursing homes and DACLCs. There's also a high prevalence of mental health disorder in nursing homes. And mental health disorder in nursing homes has been understudied, so it's somewhat difficult to come up with these numbers. But the most recent data suggests that in the community nursing homes nationally, about 58% of residents have dementia. Between 15 and 18% have serious mental illness, and by this I mean schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Between 30 and 60% have depressive disorder, and between 20 and 50% have any mental health disorder. Lemke and Schaefer in 2009 reported that as of 2006, in the VHA extended care, the prevalence of dementia was about 35%. About 20% of residents had serious mental illness, 30% had depression, 10% substance use disorder, and between 40 and 60% of them had dual diagnoses. And Fullerton has noticed that the rates of mental health disorder in nursing homes may be increasing. I'm going to talk today about the possibility that mental health disorder is a barrier to pain and pain treatment in community nursing homes and VACLCs. The basis for believing this might be the case comes from the overall literature of general population, of general patient populations, where it's been shown that mental health disorders do appear to interfere with effective treatment of medical conditions like arthritis, cardiovascular health, and diabetes. So Riedelmeyer reported that patients with psychotic syndromes were 41% less likely to obtain medical treatment for arthritis than were patients without such syndromes. Mitchell and colleagues and Peterson and colleagues reported that individuals with serious mental illness are prescribed significantly lower than expected quantities of cardiovascular medication, and they're less likely to obtain certain cardiovascular treatment procedures than are patients who do not have mental health disorders. Frayne and her colleagues have found a failure to meet diabetes performance measures is more common among VA patients who have mental health disorders, especially those patients who have substance use disorder, serious mental illness and personality disorder. And also that patients with substance use disorder receive less aggressive anti-glycemic management than do those without substance use disorder. The idea that mental health might be a barrier to effective pain care in nursing homes also comes from a considerable amount of research showing that dementia interferes with pain treatment in nursing homes. This has been well documented in many studies. And there's also evidence that gender, race, and length of stay may moderate the influence of dementia with the interference of dementia with pain assessment and treatment. This idea comes from research showing that there are sex and gender differences in pain expression and treatment seeking. Sengupta reported in 2010 that non-white residents with dementia were least likely and white residents without dementia were most likely to be reported as having pain. They also reported that among residents with dementia and pain, non-white residents were more likely than white residents to lack appropriate pain management, meaning things like standing orders or special services for pain. And work by Berlewitz has suggested that length of stay may moderate the influence through a mechanism such as clinical inertia, which is the situation where care providers over time have reduced responsiveness to patients' pain and other medical symptoms. So the specific questions that we were interested in answering are these. Do mental health disorders other than dementia interfere with the recognition and reporting of pain in community nursing homes and VOCs? Secondly, do mental health disorders other than dementia influence the types of pain treatment obtained by residents in community nursing homes and VACLCs? And third, do gender, race, and length of stay add to the influence of mental health disorder to predict pain and pain treatments received by community nursing home and VACLC residents? We obtained some information about this first from a study that we've just published in the American Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry, in which we were looking at psychiatric disorders and pain treatment in community nursing homes. We were using data from the National Nursing Home Survey data. We linked together the current resident questionnaire and long-term care medication data records from the National Nursing Home Survey data. These are publicly available data from the CDC. The sample was 13,507 community nursing home residents. They are all non-VA. Mean age in the sample was about 81 years. It was primarily women, 71%, and primarily white. To measure mental health disorder, we used the MDS 2.0 IC9 codes that appear in the National Nursing Home Survey data to identify residents with dementia, serious mental illness, depression only, substance use disorder, dual mental health disorder, two or more of the disorders above. And I should say each of these tended to be, each of the respondents would have only one of these disorders. There was not that much dual mental health disorder, but when there was, it was primarily dual diagnosis with dementia. Pain items in the MDS 2.0 are staff rated, whether or not the resident has had pain in the last 7 days, and if they are having pain, what their pain severity is. We also created a measure of missingness. There was an opportunity for the staff rater to say whether they didn't know the pain severity of the resident or if it was missing. We also used an item from the current resident questionnaire file to assess whether or not residents were obtaining a non-pharmacological pain treatment, and that is in the documentation is described as distraction, heat and cold massage, positioning, music therapy, etc. And then we went to the long-term care medication data file and used the National Drug Code therapeutic class codes to create variables indicating whether the resident had obtained non-opioid therapy, pain therapy in the last 24 hours, some opioid medication only in the last 24 hours, both opioid and non-opioid pain medication in the last 24 hours, or no pharmacological pain treatment in the last 24 hours. Then the other variables we looked at were age, gender, race, length of stay, and physical functioning to use as covariates in our analyses. I'm sorry, I forgot to skip forward to this slide. So to reiterate, the mean age in the sample was about 81. It was about 71% women and 88% white. 49% of the residents had dementia, 35% depression, 14% serious mental illness, 2% had substance use disorder, and 26% had dual diagnoses with two or more of the diagnoses above. Overall, about 70% of the sample had one or more of these mental health disorders. In the sample overall, residents reported that 25% of the residents reported had pain in the last 7 days. The mean intensity of the pain was 5.4 on a scale of 0 to 10. And about 32% of residents, the staff reported as missing or don't know for pain intensity. In the overall sample, about 32% of residents received some kind of non-pharmacological pain treatment. 21% got no pain medication. 37% received non-opioid medication only, opioid medication only for 21%, and 21% got both non-opioid and opioid pain medication. This slide shows differences between residents with and without mental health disorder on being rated as having pain in the last 7 days. So that purple bar to the right are residents without any mental health disorder, and the green bars represent the percentage with pain in the last 7 days of residents with each of the mental health disorders. The asterisks indicate that the group differences remain significant when we control statistically for age, gender, race, and functioning. So we can see from the slide that there was residents with mental health disorder were considerably less likely to be rated as having pain in the last 7 days by the nursing home staff. This slide also shows that they had lower pain severity ratings than did residents without mental health disorder. And this slide shows that residents who had mental health disorders, particularly those with dementia and dual diagnosis, were much more likely to be rated as being missing, or the staff said didn't know about the pain severity of the nursing home resident. So, just to summarize, the residents with mental health disorder were less likely to be rated by staff as having pain in the last 7 days. They were rated by staff as having less severe pain, and staff are more likely to report missing or don't know pain severity ratings for residents with mental health disorders. And most of these group differences remain statistically significant even after we adjusted for resident age, gender, race, and physical functioning. This slide shows that residents who had mental health disorder were less likely to receive non-pharmacological pain treatments than were residents without mental health disorder. residents with mental health disorder were more likely to receive non-opioid-only medications than were residents without mental health disorder. And residents with mental health disorder were less likely to receive both non-opioid and opioid pain medications than were residents without mental health disorder. So just to summarize the slides, when we compare residents with pain who did not have mental health disorders, residents with pain who had them were less likely to obtain non-pharmacological pain interventions, more likely to get non-opioid pain medication, and less likely to get both non-opioid and opioid pain treatments. We also found evidence that gender combined with mental health disorder to affect the pain in the last 7-day pain rating. So as shown in this slide, men with mental health disorder were least likely to be rated as having pain in the last 7 days, whereas women without mental health disorder were most likely to be rated as having pain in the last 7 days. With respect to effects of race, individuals who were non-white who had mental health disorders were least likely to be rated as having pain in the last 7 days. Individuals who were white without mental health disorder were most likely to be rated as having pain in the last 7 days. We called longer stay was 1 year or longer, shorter stay was less than 1 year stay. And this is showing that longer stay residents with mental health disorders were least likely to be rated as having pain, whereas shorter stay without mental health disorder were most likely rated as having pain in the last 7 days. Individuals who were longer stay with mental health disorders were most likely to receive only non-opioid pain medications for their pain. Shorter stay without mental health disorders were least likely to only get non-opioid only pain medication. So I'm going to summarize this again to point out that men with mental health disorders were least likely and women without mental health disorders most likely to be rated as having pain in the last 7 days. Non-white residents were least likely with mental health disorder were least likely. White residents without mental health disorder most likely to be rated as having pain in the last 7 days. Longer stay residents who had mental health disorder were least likely, and shorter stay without mental health disorder most likely to be rated as having pain in the last 7 days. And longer stay residents with mental health disorders were most likely, and shorter stay residents without mental health disorder least likely to be provided non-opioid medication, only medication for their pain. So we concluded from these analyses that we were finding, consistent with previous research, that mental health disorder does appear to interfere with or at least influence effective health care. We extended earlier research to show that mental health disorders besides dementia may influence the recognition and treatment of pain in community nursing homes. And we length of stay may combine with mental health disorder to influence pain recognition and treatment in community nursing homes. There were considerable limitations in the MDS 2.0 pain measures, however, and also the National Nursing Home Survey data is mainly for white women, and these data were collected almost 10 years ago. We wondered whether the results that we found in that sample would also generalize to describe the VA CLC resident population. So what I'm about to describe are results from my HSR&D IIR, looking at effects of mental health disorder on pain and pain treatments in VA CLCs. these are pretty recent analyses. It took us quite a while to get these data, so these are very recent analyses. I'll be describing to you. This study is conducted doing secondary analyses of VACLC MDS 3.0 resident assessment records. The sample I'll be describing today is of 10,706 unique VACLC residents who have between 1 and 7 MDS 3.0 resident assessment interviews conducted between July 2012 and July 2013. What I'll be describing is information from their first assessment in that time period. And I'll only be describing cross-sectional findings. So the mean age of this sample is 72 years, and it's only 3.6%. The measures we used were from the MDS 3.0, what's called the Active Disorder Checklist, and the Active Disorder IC9 modes, indicating dementia, serious mental illness, depression, PTSD, and substance use disorder. On the MDS 3.0 assessment, the staff person who's conducting the interview is asked whether a pain assessment interview should be conducted with the resident. In other words, are they able to be understood and communicate, functioning well enough to complete a self-report interview about their pain? So I'm talking now about the N of 8,300 people who were reported by the staff as being capable of participating in the interview about their pain. The residents are asked about whether they had pain at any time in the last 5 days. If they had pain, the time that they spent in pain in the last 5 days, ranging from rarely to constantly. They're asked to provide a numeric pain rating of their about their worst pain in the last 5 days, the range of that being between 0 and 10. They're asked whether pain made it hard to sleep at night in the last 5 days, and asked whether pain made it hard to do their usual activity in the last 5 days. Staff, there are items preceding the interview with the resident in which the staff are asked to record whether the resident has received non-pharmacological pain intervention in the last 5 days, whether they have scheduled pain medication in the last 5 days, and whether they've had as-needed pain medication in the last 5 days. So in this sample of 8,300, the demographic characteristics were 71 years of age, 3.7% women, and it was about 76% white. We found that 24% of the residents had dementia, 18% had serious mental illness, 28% had depression, 12% had PTSD, 4% had substance use disorder, and about 23% had dual diagnoses with two or more of the above. In the overall sample, 65% of residents reported that they had had pain in the last 5 days. Of those who had reported having pain, the mean time spent in pain was 2.8, in that range between 1 and 4. Pain interfered with their sleep. For 40% of them, pain interfered with sleep. For 46%, pain interfered with their day-to-day activities. And the mean numeric pain rating scale rating they gave was 6.4, in the range between 0 and 10. 6.5% of the residents with pain were receiving no pain treatment. 44% got non-pharmacological pain treatment. 59% had scheduled pain medication, and 81% had as-needed pain medication. This slide shows the self-reported pain in the last 5 days among residents with and without mental health disorders. This shows that residents with dementia and serious mental illness were less likely to report pain in the last 5 days than were residents without mental health disorder. On the other hand, residents with depression, PTSD, and substance use disorder were more likely to report having pain in the last 5 days than were residents without mental health disorder. This shows that the amount of time spent in pain was somewhat elevated among residents who had depression, PTSD, and substance use disorder relative to residents without mental health disorder. And this shows slightly depressed numeric pain rating scores among residents with dementia and serious mental illness compared to those without mental health disorder, and slightly elevated pain numeric rating scores among residents with PTSD and substance use disorder. This slide shows that residents who had dementia and serious mental illness were less likely than residents without mental health disorder to report that pain interfered with sleep in the last 5 days. But residents with PTSD, substance use disorder, and to some extent depression were somewhat more likely to report that pain interfered with their sleep in the last 5 days compared to residents without mental health disorders. Residents with dementia were less likely than residents without mental health disorder to report pain limiting their activities day to day. Residents with depression, PTSD, and substance use disorder were more likely to report that pain interfered with their activities, day-to-day activities, than were residents without mental health disorder. So to summarize this, one thing that's very striking is that the MDS 3.0 captures much more pain than the MDS 2.0 did. Our findings also show that residents with mental health disorder generally are less likely to self-report pain in the last 5 days, but the pattern varies by mental health disorder, where dementia and residents with dementia and serious mental illness are least likely to self-report pain. Individuals with depression and PTSD are slightly lower likelihood of reporting pain, but residents who have substance use disorder are more likely to self-report pain. Of residents with pain, those with depression, PTSD, and substance use diagnoses report spending more time in pain than do residents without mental health disorder diagnosis. Of residents with pain, those with dementia and serious mental illness report lower pain intensity, but those with PTSD and substance use disorder report higher pain intensity than do residents who do not have mental health disorder diagnosis. And of residents with pain, those with dementia are less likely, and those with depression, PTSD, and substance use disorder are more likely to report the pain interferes with their sleep and day-to-day activities than are residents without mental health disorder diagnosis. Turning to the kind of pain treatment that residents receive, residents who have mental health disorder are slightly or somewhat more likely to obtain scheduled pain medications than are residents who do not have mental health disorder, especially the residents with depression and PTSD. Residents with mental health disorder are less likely to obtain as-needed pain medications than are residents without mental health disorder. And residents who have mental health disorder, especially dementia and serious mental illness, but also somewhat depression, PTSD, and substance use disorder, are less likely to obtain non-pharmacological pain interventions than are residents who do not have mental health disorders. Now I'm going to compare what we found when looking at gender and race and length of stay in combination with mental health disorder to what we found in the National Nursing Home Survey. This is a slide from the earlier finding from the National Nursing Home Survey. This is a slide from the VACLC sample showing that, again, men with mental health disorder are least likely, women without mental health disorder most likely to report pain in the last 5 days. This is from the National Nursing Home Survey slide showing the influence of race . This is from the VACLC sample showing that non-white individuals with mental health disorder are least likely, and those who are white who do not have mental health disorder most likely to report pain in the last 5 days. This is from the National Nursing Home Survey. This is from the VACLC sample showing that longer stay residents with mental health disorder were least likely, shorter stay residents without mental health disorder most likely to report having pain in the last 5 days. This is a little bit apples and oranges, but I included these slides to show the length of stay may be having some effects in combination with mental health disorder on pain treatment. So in the National Nursing Home sample, the longer stay residents with mental health disorder were most likely, shorter stay without mental health disorder least likely to have non-opioid pain medications for their pain. And in the VACLCs, longer stay residents with mental health disorder were most likely to have scheduled pain medication, whereas those who were shorter stay without mental health disorder least likely to have scheduled pain medications. So summarizing the findings, we found in the VACLC sample that we were replicating several of the findings from the National Nursing Home 2004 data. Specifically, that men with mental health disorder were least likely, women without mental health disorder most likely to be rated as having pain in the last 5 days, non-white residents with mental health disorder least likely, and white residents without mental health disorder most likely to be self-reporting or rated as having pain in the last 5 days, and that longer stay residents with mental health disorder least likely and shorter stay residents without mental health disorder most likely to be rated as having pain or stating that they had pain in the last 5 days. And length of stay is also combining with mental health disorder to influence pain treatments, such as the likelihood of obtaining scheduled pain medication. So, in answer to our previous three questions, what are the effects of mental health disorders on pain and pain treatment in community nursing homes and VACLCs? Well, yes, it appears that mental health disorders other than dementia are influencing the recognition and reporting of pain in community nursing homes and VACLCs. Secondly, it appears that mental health disorders other than dementia are influencing the types of pain treatments that residents in community nursing homes and VACLCs are getting. And third, it appears that gender, race, and length of stay can add to or modify the influence of mental health disorder on pain and pain treatment in these settings. The question is why? So we don't think that it's just having a mental health disorder diagnosis per se that's important to consider in determining or trying to design better treatments for pain in nursing homes. it must be things related to having mental health disorder that are causing these patterns. And we have hypotheses, but we don't have data yet about why we're finding these differences. So we think that they may be coming from the resident level, resident staff interactions, and facility and systems level factors. So, for example, at the residence level, the differences might be explained by the mental health disorders themselves. For example, it's known that people with substance use disorder report pain more frequently and at higher levels than other people. We may be seeing the effects of psychoactive medications being prescribed to these residents that have pain-modifying influences. Frayne and her colleagues have focused on the cognitive and communication problems that patients with mental health disorders have that interfere with understanding and treating their medical conditions. It's also possible that the results that we found are reflecting something about the staff-resident interactions and completion of the MDS 3.0 pain interview. For example, perhaps residents who have PTSD or depression may be avoiding the pain interview, wanting to make the pain interview go more quickly, so they would tend to deny having pain. That's something that bears examination. It's possible that we find these patterns because of facility level or system level factors such as high staff turnover and lack of consistent assignment. And the idea here is that in places where there's high staff turnover and there's rotating staff assignment, the staff do not form relationships with residents that make it more likely that residents will reveal their pain, ask for help with their pain. So this is something we think may be affecting those patterns we found. Mental health disorders may appear to be influenced by the type of pain treatments that residents in community nursing homes and VLCs are getting. Again, this could be for reasons at the resident, provider, or facility system levels. It may be that residents in nursing homes have limits on their self-advocacy for getting effective pain treatment. Their communication and cognitive problems may be interfering with them getting things like non-pharmacological pain treatments. Providers may be wary of residents' polypharmacy. At the provider level, Frayne has suggested that there's bias against quote-unquote difficult patients, which may be the case with some of the residents who have mental health disorder. Oliver has noted that there's bias against residents who have history or active substance use disorder. At the provider level, providers may simply find it very difficult to manage the balancing act of prescribing medications that balance the risk of adverse medication outcomes with the risk of uncontrolled pain in residents. Hanlon has noted that at the provider level, there might be problems with, there's the adage start low. He says it, let's see. Start low, go slow. And he says that may turn into start low, stay low with pain medications and residents in nursing homes. At the facility level, there just may be limitations to the evidence base and the resources to deliver non-pharmacological and more resident-centered pain treatments. And we also can generate some hypotheses about why at the resident, provider, and facility level, race, gender, and length of stay may be adding apparently to the influence of mental health disorder to affect the kind of pain treatments that community nursing home residents get. For example, sex differences in experience and expression of pain may have influenced the findings we report. There are ethnic differences in pain sensitivity and pain coping that may be affecting the findings. And longer stay residents increase in comorbidities and frailty, and the number of medications they're taking may also be reflected in our results. At the provider level, Green has noted possible sex and race-based disparities in pain care decision-making. And Berlowitz has noted this phenomenon called clinical inertia, where over time, care providers can have a decreased responsiveness to patients' fluctuations in symptoms. And again, at the facility level, there just may be limitations to our current evidence base and our resources to deliver non-pharmacological and better resident-fitted pharmacological pain treatments. I think I'll skip this and go on to questions. I think it's about time for that.
Thank you, Dr. Brennan. We have a couple questions. Please keep them coming. Is there a procedure for actually obtaining the MDS 3.0 data, and what's involved in that?
A lot of patience and effort. The MDS 3.0 is available in two sources in VA. If you're a VA researcher, there are two sets of MDS 3.0 data. One is from CMS for the it's sourced from CMS, and it's for veterans who are residing in community nursing homes nationally. And the way to obtain that is through VIREC, through data use agreement, and you need to know that they run about, I think it's about 3 years behind. So probably now MDS 3.0 data for around 2011, maybe 12 is available. You have to do a data use agreement. The other source of the data, the VACLC data, isn't blended in with the rest of the national data. It's kept apart just for the VACLCs, and it's still sent to Austin. And it's stored in relational databases in Austin. And it eventually I was able to obtain it, but with a lot of help from VA, from the Austin Automation Center, to extract that data. And then it came in text files without variable labels and value labels, so it took us a while to make it usable. So I hope that answers the question.
Great, thank you.
Oh, I think I forgot to say that also, of course, was with, you have to do a data use agreement directly with geriatrics and extended care, and have a funded project and, IRB approval and all of that, to then get the data use agreement.
Mm-hmm. So one of the gaps between pain and treatment is among those individuals who have substance use disorders. Do your data suggest why even the non-opioid treatment is received less often among those with substance use?
I don't know what from our data would tell us exactly what's going on there. I think it may be cautiousness on the part of the care providers about providing any pain medication. It could also be on the part of the people who have the history of substance use disorder being wary of taking substances for their pain. But that's just a guess.
Here's another question. There may be a relationship between staff gender, a low percentage of male versus a higher percentage of female staff, who in return are more biased. That is, staff taking time to address the female patient's pain concerns versus less time taking to address or identify male patient pain concerns. Is that anything you came across or a hypothesis you have?
So it's the gender of the staff rater that's affecting the rating?
That's one question, but that might, you know, introduce a bias.
Well, I think that almost all of the staff raters would be female in both settings. So I don't know how much variation there would be to be able to test that hypothesis. But that's, and then you're saying that the women staff might be more attentive to the pain of the, well.
So maybe they're more attentive to the pain of women than of men.
Well, that's an interesting idea, but I don't think we have data that we can address that with.
Here's another question that, you know, maybe you just kind of hypothesized about. Do you think that consistent staff assignment would likely increase or decrease clinical inertia?
Well, in theory, it should decrease clinical inertia through the mechanism of supposedly consistent staff assignment makes the staff member more sensitive to changes in the resident, such as changes in their pain, pressure, ulcers, changes in their mood, and then the staff would be conveying that to the physicians prescribing the medication. So it should offset the clinical inertia effect in theory.
This is a little bit off your research, but this person says that in study two, there seemed to be a propensity of white residents in the CLC versus those of other races. Does this have anything to do with a lack of access or?
Is the question about the representation of white versus other races in the CLCs?
Yes.
I actually think that pretty accurately reflects the veteran the veteran demographic in the VACLCs.
Okay. So where do you think the VA needs to go in terms of then addressing pain for these subgroups that seem to be not getting as much attention, mental health patients, the male patients, the non-white patients?
Well, for one thing, I think, as I said, we need more information about what the behaviors are, what the interactions are between the staff and the residents, and what the kind of system-level constraints are, facilitators are of care for pain in the VACLCs. So I would say getting more information to the staff about and also having them have input into how they can manage those kinds of behaviors and quote-unquote difficult patients, you know, how that can help them deliver care to these residents would be one thing that the VA could work on. I think that probably in increase in resources at the facility level would help them. My impression is that actually the care providers in the CLCs would like to be providing more pain care and more frequent assessments. Some of them think that it's completely inadequate that we would only be recording residents' pain quarterly when they get their MDS assessments, that really we need much more frequent real-time attention and recording of residents paying and attention to it, but the staff of the CLCs are incredibly burdened with the very many care responsibilities they have. So it's hard to ask them to do one more thing, but it would be nice if the VA could provide the CLC staff with more tools to more frequently be in touch with the pain of residents and more training and more evidence base about what they can do to more promptly and effectively address the residents' pain issues.
A couple people have asked kind of a similar question, which is that since there are messages coming down through the BHA about not prescribing opioids to people with a history of mental health or substance abuse or use disorder, do you think that you're likely to see more of a decrease in opioid pain management in the long-term facilities?
Well, my guess would be yes. But that's what I was saying in one of the earlier slides. I mean, I think that there's a tremendous challenge with these residents because the prescribers are faced with residents who are taking a lot of different medications. These residents with mental health disorders are also taking antipsychotics and antidepressants, and there's a tremendous justified concern about adverse medication reactions. So they really do have a challenging balancing act between, you know, making sure that these adverse events don't occur, but on the other hand, not being so conservative that there's unnecessary suffering from pain going on. So I think that, you know, the question of, I think that's something that needs to be addressed. And I don't know the answer to that question. It's difficult.
One other technical question about the MDS sample. How often is it administered in the CLCs?
Oh, the it's tailored to the individual resident, and so it's given to the resident at admission, and then quarterly, annually, and at discharge. Not all of the MDS items are included in every single assessment, but it's at 3 month intervals generally. But some people only get one assessment because they're short term, so they're only there, say, at admission, and then they leave because their problem is resolved. Or they die.
Bob Kearns has a question for you. Are you there, Bob?
Hey, Bob. Can't hear you.
Okay. Maybe he can't get on the line.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Now? Great. So this is also beyond your presentation, but I wonder if you have an idea about so there's a big, you know, issue about assessment of pain in the non-communicative patient. Particularly, it gets conflated with management of pain in patients in community living centers. So one approach is actually to use acetaminophen, a trial of acetaminophen, as a known pain reliever to see if there is observed change in behavior of patients that might be an indication, really a validation, that their behavior is actually pain, an expression of pain versus anxiety or some psychomotor agitation or something other than pain. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is beyond your expertise, but I couldn't help myself in asking a question about kind of going down the path of assessment of pain in the non-communicative patient, and any thoughts about that approach in particular?
Well, actually, the MDS 3.0 has another piece. You know, as I was talking about how the staff were asked, can this person complete the self-report?
Right.
There's another, and so it all, but it's a bifurcation where it's, if the answer is no, then you go on and you complete some pain indicator items for the residents who are judged not to be able to give a self-report. So they're actually,
right.
we actually have that data too, which I didn't, and we've begun to analyze those data. So that captures information about the people who are uncommunicative and cannot do the self-report interview. And interestingly, when we look at, we were looking at the differences between those who are in this not capable group, the ones who get the pain ratings instead of self-reports, this pattern of the mental health disorders being fewer, people who have the mental health disorders are less likely to be noted as having the pain indicators, like the grimacing and the body movements and things that are supposed to indicate pain. So we found that pattern also in this group of people who can't self-report pain. But getting back to your question, I mean, one could use the MDS data possibly to examine the hypothesis that you just presented about the, because you could use the MDS longitudinally.
Yep.
You could see, you could find out, let's see, how would you know if they're getting acetaminophen if that's recorded in the pharmacy databases, which is a question. But but you could point
so that. This is just really interesting work, generally speaking. And, in fact, you know, my concern about, as many on the call likely know, about use of standardized observational approaches like the pain ad, which has had great interest in VA, is that, you know, all of the work still is without, you know, one of the challenges is discriminating pain from, for example, emotional distress.
Mm-hmm.
And actually your data kind of prompted me about this because it may well be that you know, there's either an over or there's a bias in terms of attributing observations to either a known mental health condition or not.
Mm-hmm.
In the context of assessing pain. So that trying to tease that apart, I mean, I don't have any simple idea about it, but it does seem like your data could provide another opportunity to kind of really address that
mm-hmm.
question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I know we're near the hour. I don't often get to say this. Thank you, Penny. This was a really interesting and important presentation, and your work is really exciting. And I thank you publicly for contributing to this session.
Thank you.
I just want to reiterate that this was a great presentation, and I think the audience was really had kind of many future questions in terms of the direction of where this research should go. So that was really exciting to hear. Just one more reminder, folks can hold on for the feedback form to come up. We are going to resume our cyber seminar series in September, starting Tuesday, September 1st. You will get the information about the exact title and the presenter's name in mid-August. I want to thank everyone for joining us at this HSR&D Cyber Seminar, and we hope to see you at a future session.
Thank you.